DigiTiki.com.
Although we're not known for playing jazz, we have several of the world's leading jazz musicians playing with us in the orchestra today. You're hearing one of them now. Larry, do you have an extra pair of mallets?
Sure, Les.
Thank you. You go first.
Okay.
Welcome to the Quiet Village.
Okay,
Mark.
Yes.
Great to see you again.
It is great to have you back. This is wonderful. I'm so excited.
I just had a great time in part one. I was reminded of a luncheon that I went to in Beverly Hills, and I was lucky enough to sit next to Liza Minnelli.
Oh my goodness.
Wow. Yes. And I was feeling very unfortunate because I think Dad had just passed, and she was feeling very unfortunate because she had just done an interview, a live interview with a very important talk show host, and she just completely blanked. You know, the talk show host was trying to say, give me some stories about Judy Garland and growing up, and you know, she couldn't think of one thing. You know, she probably had a million stories. And, you know, all she could think to say to them was, my parents got up and went to work in the morning and they came home at night. and that's what happens sometimes in an interview, you know?
Yeah.
But we had a nice conversation, and it reminded me that sometimes you love to do interviews, but you lose your train of thought. So hopefully we'll do better than part one. And I did share a story with her because I knew her mother very well, Judy. Mm-hmm. And because she was feeling a little down, I said, well, you know, your mother changed my life. And she said, how? And I said, well, you know, my mother had just died, and she had come over and tucked me into bed and kissed me goodnight.
Wow. Judy Garland tucked you in.
Yeah. Well, my dad knew that would be the only thing that would fix me. I was a huge fan of Judy Garland. So, she really appreciated that. And I said, you know, your mom was a wonderful woman. And she said, well, tell me about your dad. I said, well, he was very complicated, you know, but he absolutely loved what he did. And he said, well, that was the difference then between your mom, your dad, and my mom. She said, I'm not sure my mom loved what she did. And that always stuck with me, you know, because Dad was absolutely obsessed with creating music, you know. He absolutely adored what he did. Mm-hmm. And he sat at the piano from early morning till evening composing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether he will go down in history as being a great composer, because I'm not a musician and I'm not a composer, but I think he will go down in history as being one of the most interesting composers. And I think he took risks where other people did not. And, you know, he had so many other facets to his personality. You know,
Yeah, your description, all the different things that he was into, he sounded like a true Renaissance man.
Well, he was very bohemian. Yeah, He was like, it was like living with someone who was, you know, an expert on the Antique Roadshow, you know. He just, you know, which is why he didn't care much for the Hollywood set, because he didn't really want to go to Hollywood parties and talk about Hollywood. You know, he knew the Latin names of all of the plants in the world.
Oh, my goodness.
He knew every culture, everything they ate, what they wore, how they, their religious beliefs. So he was so complex. I think that reflected in his music. I don't know for sure. Like I said, I'm not a composer, songwriter, but I think that made Dad a better composer.
I would have to agree with you. I mean, the breadth of his subject matter in his compositions is much, much wider than a lot of other people.
I think so too. And the horror movies, I absolutely, you know, I've never watched one of Dad's horror movies because the soundtracks are so beautiful.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want the movie to ruin it.
Yeah. You
A lot of them were really kind of iffy B movies.
Yeah.
One of my favorite was The Dunwich Horror. Oh, you have to listen to the score.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. But the movie is trash. So anyway, I think, you know, he was just a remarkable, complex man who was fearless in his composing, took great risk, and it paid off for him.
Yeah. I would say so, yeah.
And we'll see how history judges him, you know? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think so far he's got a lot of fans and it's still growing.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I hope that he's not forgotten in the long term, you know.
Definitely not. Definitely not. Now, you had mentioned there was a Brazil story.
Well, yeah. Dad very much liked South America, Latin America. It reflected a lot in his music. And he had met the consulate of Brazil and was guest of honor at Carnival in Rio, which
wow.
is mind-boggling, you know. I don't know if you know anything about Carnival, but it is, you know, it makes New Orleans Carnival look like a four-year-old birthday party.
Yeah.
Carnival in Rio is quite spectacular, and we went down there several times and just had a wonderful time, and Dionne Warwick was with us at one time.
Wow.
And that was wonderful to see her samba, you know, in the streets with, you know, all these people in costume, and, you know, it was just a marvelous life traveling with Dad.
that must really be something. I've seen videos of Carnival, right, from like some of the Brazilian stations on satellite,
right,
and it looks beyond belief. I can't imagine.
They spend years preparing for it. The costumes, you know, go upwards of $100,000-$200,000, and you know, each samba school competes against each other, and there are 2,000 members in one samba school, you know, and you have these thousands and thousands of people going down the street in these costumes and this marvelous music. It's indescribable. It should be on everybody's bucket list.
Yeah, it's on mine.
Good, I hope so.
I hope to get down there one of these days just to check it. I have been a real big fan of Brazilian music, you know, bossa, samba.
Right.
It just, there's something about it that is...
Well, get your hands on every video you can of Carnival.
Okay.
In Rio de Janeiro.
Okay.
It's really quite spectacular.
Well, your dad also did a whole record, Brazil Now, that was
like an English teacher knows how to deconstruct a sentence. I'm not a composer, so I don't really understand each one of my father's albums, mm-hmm, and exactly what style per se they are.
Yeah.
But I knew he drew from his travels when he wrote music.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. He did,
you know, Sacred Idol and African Jazz and
yes,
Ritual of the Savage all were drawn, you know, from his travels.
That is, I just love that, because that actually gives those albums a little more weight, you know. It wasn't,
well, I'm hoping so. I hope that history will see that, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to move on to, you said you had a Disney and Tiki Room story too.
Well, you know, it's funny because I have a favorite saying that youth is wasted on the young, you know?
No. Yes.
And my grandmother and Lillian Disney were very good friends. And so there were many casual dinner parties, and Walt, Lillian, and my mother and father and I and my grandparents would sit around the dinner table talking about Disneyland and inventing the Tiki Room, mm-hmm, and me having no idea of the importance of what I was witnessing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just can't believe at my age that I was actually there watching the creation of this magnificent legacy that Walt Disney, you know, had mm-hmm created. And he was such a fan of dad's music, he would come over and he would bring these sketches, beautiful sketches of the Tiki Room, and talk to dad about the flowers and what kind of flowers and what kind of birds and, you know, and music. And it's remarkable, you know, to think that you were a part of history.
Yeah. And he never tapped your dad to compose stuff for rides?
No,
or anything?
He knew better than anyone what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't need dad to do the music. I don't know. I know now they have their own, you know, in-house composers and musicians. But at the time, he was more interested in my father helping him achieve authenticity.
Uh-huh.
in the tiki room.
Wow.
Maybe couldn't afford that at the time.
Well, your dad was probably so busy he might not have even had the time. It just he was always
I don't know. It was
cranking.
It was a wonderful time. And through that, we met Benita, and Jack Rather owned the rights to Lassie. And so they had hired Dad to do the Lassie show.
Oh, nice.
And that whistle, you know, at the end of the Lassie show that we all love so much, you know, was written by Dad. Which is just so marvelous.
That's great. I love that. Yeah, he had a lot of scoring gigs.
Yeah. They were a bit sketchy. A lot of B movies.
Yeah.
And he and Hank were good friends. Henry Mancini.
Yeah.
And, you know, Hank waited for the good projects.
Okay.
And Dad just took anything that was thrown at him.
Yeah.
You know, he just wanted to do anything he could. He just wanted to create constantly. He wanted to write all the time.
That's
so
fantastic.
Anything that he was offered, he would take. And because he wasn't a bright, shiny penny like Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra, and, you know, he didn't care about impressing people in that way. It was okay with him if he did, you know, Panic in the Year Zero and Wild in the Streets. He would have much rather worked and done whatever he wanted and had, you know, free reign creatively than wait for the right picture or the right situation, you know, to make a lot of money. And he was adored Roger Corman. And so they got together. Do you know who Roger Corman is?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. He and Roger were very good friends. And Roger owned or ran American International Pictures. So they teamed up and they just cranked out those B movies like there was no tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Some of the B movies from back in the 50s have become classics now.
I know. Whenever whenever summer starts, the beach movies start playing. Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon. Dad did all of those, you know. And so it's fun to watch. You know, whether or not he's, like I said, he's going to be considered a great composer, I don't know. But I can promise you he was the most interesting composer you have ever met in that genre.
I don't doubt that one bit. I love his compositions. They're very rich. They're not...
What do you mean by that? Because I don't, you know, not being a musician... people say things like rich and lush. Does that mean more complex or?
There's a level of complexity that's not inaccessible. In other words, he didn't get so out there complex that it's too cerebral to get into.
Right.
His arrangements are just everything when I listen to it as a musician, I listen to an arrangement and I think that's exactly what I'd do with that instrument right there at that moment. Yeah, his arrangement, and you listen to what the other instruments are doing. You know, you can listen to the track as a whole, listen to the song as a whole, but you can also drill into it and pay attention to, well, here's what the harp is doing, or here's what the clarinets or the woodwinds are doing, and you realize there's a lot there that's fascinating. It's not there, it doesn't sound like corners were cut when writing the parts for the instruments.
All right. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that because I admired my father so much for being so fearless with his music. I could tell when he was at the piano with his friend Hall Daniels, who was vigorously writing everything down that Dad was doing on the piano that day, and they were going back and forth and saying, let's do this here and let's do that here. I just felt like, and I know I'm his daughter, but I felt like I was in the company of a brilliant man. I mean, I really felt like he knew what he was doing, and he was doing something very special.
I
And
agree.
I felt, I have always felt so honored to be in the presence of someone who was so intelligent and was so creative and did his homework.
Yeah. And that brings me to the couple of quick videos that you had sent me. I was absolutely blown away. He moves over to the vibes and plays it like a virtuoso.
Well, he played 11 instruments masterfully.
Yeah. And then he played the bongos perfectly.
Yeah. No, the only thing he didn't play, he even played the harp beautifully.
Oh.
But the only thing he didn't play, which I never saw him play, was the violin. And I don't know why, but everything else, he was absolutely magnificent and spoke four languages. Four or five languages, you know. He just knew, and he felt really comfortable around, more comfortable around people like Beverly Ford and who was on the xylophone in the video?
I don't know who that is. I wasn't
Oh,
sure.
very famous.
Larry, yes, he calls him Larry.
Larry, do you have an extra pair of mallets?
Sure, Les.
Thank you. You go
Yeah.
first.
Okay. Okay.
Some bongos, Jerry.
All right.
Here we go.
That's not hard at all, Les.
Oh, here he is again.
He was much more comfortable around Louis Armstrong, Nat King Cole, Larry Bunker, Beverly Ford, who provided a more colorful version of music than say the standard fare of that day, you know, in the 50s. He was not a popular star like Pat Boone or Andy Williams, or you know, he was much more eclectic.
And that's interesting because he wrote, you know, big orchestral pieces that, you know, had to be followed, but it sounds like he also gravitated towards the little jazz combos that were freer to improvise.
Right, right. He wrote a couple of symphonies, mm-hmm. and they're still in boxes.
Oh.
And he wrote a beautiful Broadway show after we came back from Brazil on one of our trips. I had gotten in a lot of trouble in Brazil. I had gone off on my own and had hiked up into the favelas.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which are the poorest part of Brazil.
Right.
Which were very dangerous at the time. And realized that the men coming out of the little metal huts were looking at me like, here's a target, you know. And this old man came out from behind this hut, and he didn't have any legs. He was on a like a pallet with wheels, and he said, get on. So I jumped on, and he said, hold on. And we went down the hill, and he said, you've got to get out of here, you know.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
You know,
what a story.
Blondes in a white dress don't belong up at the top of the hill, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. So we wild. Had a good time. And we lived, you know, he had a house in Hawaii and, you know, a house in Mexico. I used to kid him about Mexico because he lived in the jungle in Mexico. And he would call me or I would call him I would worry about him being down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would call him to see how he was. And he would say, oh, I'm fine. And I said, well, what are you doing? What do you do all day? And he said, well, right now I'm watching two alligators wrestle in my pond.
Oh,
and I said, okay. And I said, well, then what are you going to do? And he said, well, we're probably going to barbecue some weird kind of meat. when you go to Mexico, you can, you know, get these villas in the jungle that come with a staff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he would just go and whatever happened, happened. He was fearless, you know.
That is, I love that story. That's great.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, you know, Jeff Chennault, right? Do you know
Jeff? Oh, yes. Great guy.
I love Jeff. He's a sweetheart. And he did a little talk recently at a Tiki event last year. About your dad, like collecting his records and stuff, because he's got a huge collection.
Was that at Exoticon?
Exoticon, yeah.
Right, right.
And one of the things I found fascinating was he was talking about your dad when synthesizers came out. He embraced them and he wanted to learn about them and he started to incorporate them, which I find fascinating. It sounds like your dad just had a real thirst for knowledge. He was like
absolutely. And, you know, at first when they came out, he was mad because he didn't like the fact that, you know, you could do on a synthesizer what he used to do in the studio with 30 or 40 musicians. You know,
mm-hmm.
some of the synthesizers you could a lot of, if I'm not mistaken. Musicians lost their jobs, you know, studio musicians,
yeah.
because of synthesizers and you know, the imitation violin. But he embraced it eventually. Because when he met, I think Peter Theremin, you know, my father learned how to play the theremin, you know, and taught other musicians how to play the theremin. So there wasn't any instrument that he couldn't pick up and probably master.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I had another, I read an article about, I forget who it was. It was another famous musician who said, well, you know, synthesizers, you still have to know music to play a synthesizer.
Right, right. I think Dad's sadness was that he enjoyed working with, you know, people like Larry Bunker and he had always had beautiful, very large string sections in his compositions, and that was cut down from the use of synthesizers, unless you were in a studio doing a motion picture.
Yes. I can see that. It must have been expensive to have a huge orchestra like that.
Yeah, and Capitol knew that. And so difficult time, I think. And from my perspective, for a lot of musicians, you know, at that time.
Yeah. Well, tell
what
me.
Else,
yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
What else about Exoticon did you enjoy? Or Jeff's talk?
Well, it was nice to see Jeff. I, you know, I see him maybe what every 3 years or so.
Right.
And it was great. He actually stayed at my house during Exoticon, which was really nice.
Oh, good.
So we got to hang out. But one of the things that was, you know, outside of his talk, one of the things that I enjoyed the most was I got to meet Kapiolani Lyman, who's Arthur Lyman's daughter.
Oh, yes.
And she,
beautiful girl.
She's wonderful. And we just hit it off immediately. I gave her a copy of my album. I had a copy of the Arthur Lyman record with her on the cover, too. And she autographed that for me. So that was wonderful because Arthur Lyman is basically he's basically my vibraphone.
Really?
Hero.
Yeah. I'm going to have to listen. Yeah.
Very mellow. And actually that record, Lahaina Sunset, was kind of an homage to his sound, which was very relaxed.
Nice.
And, when I was 5 years old, I found my mom's Arthur Lyman record, which was Bahia. And, I was hooked with the bird calls and the exotic sounds. So 5 year old boy playing that record every day.
Oh, I'm going to have to go back and listen because I don't like being hit over the head with Exotica.
Yeah.
And if Arthur Lyman has a more mellow approach, I would really love to hear that. I'm going to have to. So you would recommend Bahia?
Yes. I just for my own, I think it's a good overall record. It's got the classic Exotica tracks. And it shows off his little combo really good. It's only four guys, but they make the sound of about 10 musicians. They all play
multiple.
Oh, that'll
be exciting. Oh, I can't wait.
So now I'm going back to something you said. You said he has a symphony sitting in a box. It's never been recorded.
We have quite a few boxes of unheard, unrecorded music. So my son Tom thought that it would be a very good idea if we got someone in there who really knew what they were doing and possibly analyzed Dad's music for textbooks for schools.
Oh, absolutely.
For university libraries. So my son is working on a big project. Trying to organize my father's music and get it into textbooks for kids in music school.
I think that's a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things, including some of the scores that could be definitely taught as classic examples of what to do with a specific situation.
I'll take your word for it. I have no idea.
Yeah, I think that's great. Well, you know, maybe it may also be fun that someday some of that stuff could be recorded and
I hope
and
so.
Heard.
Yeah. I think, you know, I've sort of bowed out now. I like to tell the fun, interesting stories about Dad and his personality or his creative process. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to leave my son, Tom, to do the, you know, the marketing and the public relations and the cataloging and just making sure that the legacy is passed on to his son, and you know, on and on.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
He's dad's legacy.
I love that. I love the fact that he was such a prolific composer, and there's still material that hasn't been heard.
Oh, yeah. There was a beautiful Broadway. I know what. When we were talking about Brazil, Dad wrote a Broadway show, a full show.
Oh, my goodness.
Broadway musical, and had someone do all of the sketches of the costumes, and Dad put the whole thing together himself.
Wow.
Hired all the right people to you know, do the sketches and design the Dad even designed the costumes, you know, for the show, and took it to Niederlander, who at the time owned all of the big Broadway houses in New York. And he said, I've got to have this, you know, let's do it.
Wow. And
just before he cut my father a check for a lot of money, he had a heart attack. He passed away.
Oh, no.
Mr. Niederlander died. And so, you know, with all the complicating issues of his estate and his ownership of all the Broadway houses, Dad's show got sort of pushed to the side, but it's still there, you know.
So there's
someday
symphonies and a Broadway show that hasn't been
and
heard.
A Broadway show, yeah.
That is phenomenal. Yeah, I it just, again, my mind goes to like I just imagine what it must be like.
he was like a mad scientist, you know.
Yeah.
When it came to creating music, and which is interesting in the fact that by talking to him, you would never know that he was very cool and calm and collected, but he had a lot of charisma and an enormous amount of knowledge.
It sounds like it.
So many subjects.
Yeah. Yeah. Food, wine, travel, music, art, it just...
Everything. He could walk into a furniture store or an antique store and tell you what period something was, who the, you know, the 18th century, you know, woodworker was that made it, you know. There's one more thing I want to talk about.
Okay.
Dad's girlfriends.
Okay.
He had the best taste in women that I've ever. Dated. Yeah. Sally Kellerman was one of his dates or girlfriends. And she was the most marvelous person you'd ever. Do you know who she is?
Yeah. She played Hot Lips Houlihan, didn't she?
Right. Sally Kellerman. And the other gal that I absolutely adored was Petula Clark.
Really?
Petula Clark was one of the nicest, kindest, most wonderful people, and would stay with us quite a bit. And those were the highlights for me as a child. Sally, wow. Meeting Sally and Petula Clark.
Yeah. Well, and having being tucked in by
that was extraordinary.
Yeah, but gosh, my brain, Judy Garland.
Judy Garland.
I kept thinking Liza Minnelli, but that wasn't it. It was Judy Garland.
Judy Garland. Well, you know, it was a difficult time, and Dad was very famous at the time, and Mom had just passed away. And Martha Ray lived down the street. Do you know who she is?
Yes. Yeah.
So Martha Ray would come up and try and cheer us all up, and that never worked. So finally, Dad called Judy and said, you've got to come over and do something about my daughter. And it was a magical moment for me. She came into my room and tucked me in and said, you know, it's going to be okay.
Oh, wow.
Which is fantastic. Why when I saw Liza Minnelli at that luncheon, and she was so upset that she had messed up this interview. I told her, look, you know, don't worry. We've all been there.
Yeah, I can't.
Well, darling, I don't want to keep you too long. Okay.
I don't want to keep you either. I don't.
No,
know.
I'm fine, darling.
Is there I could anything? Talk for hours.
Well, I'm not as articulate as I usually. Since I moved to Northern Nevada, I'm been have a perpetual cold.
Oh.
I'm allergic to sage. So.
Oh my
but,
gosh.
If there's anything that you want to ask me, or is there anything that people want to know about Dad that they don't know or don't think they know?
I think you covered a lot of it, because one of the things I think that, like I said earlier on, is the idea that the exotica, the mystic lands kind of world that your dad created, you know, I think there's this automatic assumption that it was Hollywood generated. It wasn't real. And you just told me something that blew my mind, which was the fact that it was real. Your dad went to these places and he brought back this inspiration to do those that do that type of music, which is yes. fascinating.
You're correct. You know, not only must you have the musical talent, but you also have to have the insight and foresight to realize you can't just learn an instrument. You must go live
yep.
the instrument.
Yes, you because know. I believe that music is, at its essence, it is pure emotion that has been distilled down into a sound.
Exactly.
You know, it's something that when it's done well, you can't really define it as the notes. When you look at the notes on the page, it's you're not going to look at that and say, well, that's great music. It's not until it's performed in a way that's not tangible, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, when Dad spent from the time I left for school in the morning at 7 a.m. and got home at 4 in the afternoon, my father was in the exact same place he was in the morning at the piano bench.
Yeah.
With a man named Hall Daniels.
Mm.
And every note, every time they would experiment on the piano, they would talk about the places they had been that inspired. So you can't just know how to play the piano or the guitar or the violin or the drums. You have to have the inspiration behind it.
Absolutely.
Or you're never going to be able to grab people and hold their soul.
I couldn't agree more. That's it. You have to live something.
Right.
To do that. That is just.
And I hope that doesn't sound too simplistic, but it's the essence of who my father was.
Yeah. No, not simplistic at all. I think it's far more complicated than it sounds. You know, to be able to just say you got to get out and live it. That's easy to say, but to have said he went out and lived this stuff that he wrote about, I think. Again, that's my big takeaway from talking with you.
And oh, God.
I'm absolutely...
Authenticity.
Yes.
And no ego. No ego. You must be humble.
I cannot thank you enough
for
coming on and talking and sharing this information. It's just wonderful to hear. It has
been my pleasure. And I'm so grateful to be able to connect with you, and I'm so happy that you have put out your beautiful record, and I hope you don't have too much editing to do.
No, this was...
I'm not, because of my age and circumstance, my mind doesn't flow as easily as someone in their 30s. But it's been an absolute delight to speak with you. And I look forward to you putting out more music in the future.
Thank you. Thank you. I do. I'm trying to, I want to do a second album, and I've actually been working on a movie soundtrack for, it's a documentary, for a personality in Los Angeles that wants to do her own documentary. And, that was fun. It was not the kind of music I normally do. It was very different, kind of rock and roll-ish. But I enjoyed doing that. I just wish the thing would come out.
You know, when I first met David Crosby, David was one of my favorite of all the young men. You know, I really didn't care much for the Beatles, at Paul McCartney, and you know, I mean, they were nice people, but you know, I found
you hung out with them too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one of them, my dad, said, listen, I've got to go to Brentwood Country Mart. Can you take care of Leslie while I'm gone? You know, so I was babysat, basically, by one of the Beatles. I have no idea which one who it was, you know. But David Crosby was a very soulful young man. Mm-hmm. And he was very thoughtful. And I think you have that thoughtfulness that you'll be able to rise to the occasion of having to duplicate AC/DC.
Right.
So don't worry.
It was, I mean, they used it. So that was great. Leslie, I want to thank you again from the bottom of my heart for coming on the show and sharing this wonderful information. This is the stuff I like. I tend to geek out on details, but it's also finding all the little human things that I really enjoy. And I love the stories, and I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show.
And I thank you as well, darling. And it was such a joy meeting you and being part of Quiet Village. Thank you for the interview, and I'll talk soon.
Okay. Aloha.
All right. Aloha. Bye-bye.
Big mahalo to Leslie Baxter for coming on The Quiet Village. I hope you all enjoyed and learned as much as I did from these two episodes. It really was fascinating, and I really enjoyed that. I hope you did too. Well, my Mai Tai is empty, so we've come to the end of another visit here at The Quiet Village. I hope you enjoyed this, and want to remind you, you can go to The Quiet Village at any time by simply going to digitiki.com. You can get a complete rundown of all of the Les Baxter tunes that were used on this episode, as well as all the tunes played on previous episodes. You can stream previous episodes, and you can also listen to Quiet Village Radio, so you can get your dose of Tiki 24/7. So I'm going to leave you with a tune, like I usually try and do. I'm going to leave you with just an absolutely beautiful, lush song, and it kind of keeps in the tiki theme. This is a Les Baxter tune. This is from Ports of Paradise, which is a wonderful album, and I absolutely love this song. It's called, what else? It's called Tahiti, A Summer Night at Sea. So you can imagine going on a cruise in the 50s or 60s, and you know, you go to bed at night at sea, and you wake up in the morning, and you open the curtains to your balcony suite and see the islands of Tahiti outside. That's just what I get from this piece. Anyway, until next time, everyone, don't just say aloha, live aloha. Try and make the world a tiny bit better when you go to bed as it was when you found it in the morning. Until next time, everyone, aloha.